Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to. So thanks a lot for downloading this podcast and giving it a go. This will be the last episode that I release in 2010, probably 2011 by the time it gets up here on the feed. Yeah, I hope you've enjoyed it. This is now 3 years worth of science fiction book review podcasting for me. I started at the beginning of 2008, gone through 2009 and 2010. Episode 116 this is. That's probably around about 116 books reviewed, maybe a bit more, maybe a bit less, because some of the special episodes I don't review a book, and in some of the special episodes I review more than one book, and other episodes which aren't counted I review books as well. A bit like the last episode that I put out, it wasn't a book review or anything like that, but I just put it in the feed. I thought it would be fun to put it in there before the new year, which is just a podcast that I was a guest on the Geek Nights podcast as well, so hopefully you enjoy that. I'm talking about history in the Bible with Rim and Scott from Geek Nights. So what have we got here? Yes, so today's review for the last book of the year is Flowers for Algernon by Daniel Keyes. Let me quickly just look up on goodreads.com here. I've got the page open. Yeah, so it was first published as a short story back in 1960 or 1959 and won the Hugo Award for short fiction. And then it was actually expanded into a book and published in 1966 and won the Nebula Award for best novel. Oh, I think that's a retroactive Nebula Award that he gets there for this. So paperback book, it says here 324 pages. I read it as an ebook, so I'm not quite sure how many pages it had in the version that I had as well. But I realised actually I'd never read the full novel before. I'd read the story, but only ever the short story in a short story collection. It's one of those masterworks or, you know, best short stories. I think it was a Robert Silverberg, quite a famous compilation of great science fiction stories from the beginning half of, I say the beginning half of the 20th century. It's not, this was like, say, 59, but, you know, the first years as well. I think there's a two-volume compilation. So that's where I read it from. So I thought I knew the story. I thought, reading the last book that I reviewed here, The Speed of Dark by Elizabeth Moon, it really reminded me of this book. So I decided to read it again, and I found it as an ebook and not as an official ebook. It was like a PDF, obviously scanned from something. So it was a bit weird actually, because if you read this book before, you'll know the language use, that I mean the writing style is very unique, but then to have some transcription errors on top of that made this book quite an interesting read. So it's a bit strange for me to review like two books which have, you know, on the surface about the same subject, about someone who is mentally disabled or, you know, mentally retarded in some way, having the an offer of an operation to let them increase their intelligence. Now, Speed of Dark by Elizabeth Moon is mostly about someone who the offer is there, and it's about someone with, you know, learning difficulties or, you know, some kind of autistic spectrum disorder, sort of working out if they want to take the surgery or not, if they want to be part of this experimental treatment or not. And you know, this book is different because it's like right away it is someone who is who does have this, you know, severe learning difficulties, learning disability, and gets the operation, experimental operation done straight away. So yeah, strange to review two books back to back, but I'm going to try and avoid mentioning Speed of Dark too much in this book, because if you're interested in that, go back and listen to the last episode. Also, I wasn't really quite sure what I could say about this book. It really touched me, and I really like thoroughly enjoyed it. But in the same way that I was, you know, after reading Slaughterhouse-Five for the first time, it affected me on such a deep level, it sort of touched me at such a deep level that I wasn't quite sure where to begin when reviewing it. And then, of course, the review runs away from me. So maybe I've got a lot more to say. I went through and made some notes here, and it turns out that I've probably had a lot more to say than I originally thought. But yeah, let's see if I can get through these notes in under an hour. I don't want to keep doing, you know, hour-long podcasts. I'll see if I can do this a bit shorter. So the world that this book is set in is like 1950s, 1960s, I guess, era New York, a little bit about, you know, other places outside of New York City, but it's mostly set in New York City. Although the real setting is, of course, the mind of the protagonist, which is pretty much the way it should be in every book. Like, that is like the landscape of the book is actually inside the mind of the protagonist. But here it is even more so, of course, that's the point of the whole book, really. And that's about it, really. Just the only science fictional element, you know, that's different from the real world, or the difference between the real world of the 1960s America, 1950s, 1960s America, is, you know, the central scientific advance, which is this, you know, this cure for... Well, not so much a cure, it's like a... Well, let me explain. The plot of the book is, if we follow the Charlie, and Charlie is mentally, you know, retarded, learning difficulties kind of thing. It's never exactly clear what's wrong with him, but he's very dim. His memory is weak. He never really gets through, you know, he only gets through life by getting himself into routines that he knows, and, you know, keeps repeating the routine over and over again. But he really doesn't have any, like, connections with people around him. But what he does want to be is smart. He doesn't know why he wants to be smart, but it comes out later in the book. He wants to be smart because his mother was always forcing him to be smart. And he's like, you're not stupid, you're just lazy, you can learn and stuff like that. But of course, he doesn't remember that very much, but he just has this drive in him that he wants to be smart. So he learns how to read and write a little bit from, you know, going to this course at this local college where the teacher, Alice, teaches him, you know, how to read and write a little bit. So, because he is really, really wanting to improve and really wanting to become more intelligent and smarter, as he says at the beginning of the book, Alice, the teacher, puts his name forward to this experimental unit at this college. It's just like medical, that do medical experiments and experimental surgery procedures. And so he becomes a test subject, and he has surgery to increase his mental capabilities. And his intelligence increases over the course of, say, the first half of the novel. He starts off with an IQ of, like, I think it's about 65 or 70 or something, like, really, really low. And by midway through the book, his mental capacity has reached an IQ of his intelligence quota is... quotient, not quite sure what it is, about 180 something. And there is this mouse in the book which has also had this experimental treatment done before Charlie, and the mouse is called Algernon, which is a funny name, but there it is. And Algernon, partway through the book, starts to become a bit flaky and then starts losing his capabilities. So tragically, Charlie's capabilities also, you know, his increased intelligence leads him to discover that the same thing is probably going to happen to him. And then, big spoiler here, by the end of the story, Charlie loses his newfound abilities. Now, that is a massive spoiler that I've given there, but that's pretty much what this book is known for and the style of the book. So if you didn't know that already, I'm very sorry. But still read the book. It's still worth it to read the book. You know, I knew the story, you know, the overall story before going into it this time, mainly because I'd read the short story, and also just because it's a famous story, and you know, you may have seen the film, or, you know, this kind of thing. And also, you know, it is a tragedy. I can't say the word. Fuck it. So you sort of see it coming anyway. So, like I say, the plot is kind of simple, that it's sort of like boy meets scientist, boy becomes more intelligent, boy meets girl, boy becomes less intelligent, kind of story. But along the way, there's many subplots as well. For example, Charlie works in a bakery, and as he becomes more intelligent, you know, he sees that everybody has been taking advantage of him. You know, his boss has been paying him sort of like no wages at all. And, you know, also all the people that he thought were his friends have just been ridiculing him and laughing at him rather than with him, even though he's been laughing with them while they're laughing at him, just because he's not intelligent enough to understand that. So there's that kind of subplot there. You know, the whole point that I mentioned before about him remembering more and more about his childhood, and he tracks down his mother and his father and his sister, and there's all of that kind of, you know, backstory is revealed over time as he remembers more and more about his childhood. You know, he falls in love with his teacher, Alice, you know, and that sort of relationship develops, and it becomes strained as he becomes, you know, first of all, he's less intelligent than her, and then becomes more intelligent than her. And there's also the same kind of thing, well, not the same kind of thing, but, you know, he goes through similar experiences with other people as his mental capabilities increase and surpass the people that he's interacting with. He goes to Chicago and takes part in a scientific conference, you know, but he finds himself in a position of he's just the exhibit, even though intellectually he feels above the level of the scientist that he's with, you know. And also there's the subplot which is involving the capabilities and the motivations of the scientists themselves as they go through the book. So, like I say, the plot is interesting. The subplots are very interesting as well. I really love how different things play out in different unexpected ways. But the overall plot device which is looking at the world and relationships from a single perspective, but a changing perspective is, I think, quite genius. It's like the range of opinions that Charlie expresses is wide and changes chapter by chapter, and you sort of go with it because you realise that the rate of change of his intellect is, you know, is based on this, like, scientific, well, not scientific, is this fantasy procedure. So the whole book is a fantasy about, you know, someone who grows and in such a way. In the way I'm trying to say, though, is like you go through the same journey through life, and you can read whole books about, you know, people growing up and they're idiots when they're kids. Well, I say idiots, you know, kids are idiots. They don't quite understand what's going on with the world in ways that adults do. But, you know, there's this different outlook on life, that it's not that they don't understand what's going on in the world. It's just that, you know, it doesn't matter to them in some ways. I don't want to, like, analyse what childhood is and what growing up into adulthood is really right now. But, you know, you go from the idiocy to enlightenment and then back into idiocy, you know, which mirrors that of the human, you know, of the human childhood, is what you return to in old age. You know, and that's what this book does. You know, the end reminds me a bit of Earth Abides in that way, where, you know, how the mind of the protagonist is fogged by old age and forgetfulness and things like that, and, you know, that same kind of restricted view of the world which a child may have. Now, many books compress this, like, mental journey of a lifetime into a single novel, but here the journey of the mental journey of a lifetime is sort of compressed into a single year, or just a period of a few months. Of course, you know, it starts in the summer. No, the book follows, mostly set in the summer, you know, where he has new birth in the spring and sort of the expected outcome in the autumn, which, you know, like I said before, maybe is a common theme in this kind of book, maybe, looking back at Elizabeth Moon's book. Anyway, so we see this changing perspective of one person compressed, but, you know, in setting the setting stays the same, though, and the other characters stay the same. If not the same, you know, they're reacting to the situations that Charlie puts them in, but their mental capabilities stay the same, but their roles change in different ways. Unlike a book which is set over someone's lifetime, how, of course, you know, the parents are going to die before them, and then, you know, their children grow up as well. Here, the other people, you know, stay the same, except, of course, his own family, which, you know, as Charlie starts remembering back over time, and he remembers what his sister was like when he was little, and then he meets his sister as well, and, of course, you know, there's change there as well, which is very strange. And I said before, this book is tragic, but, like, in the true sense of tragedy. I said it right that time, yeah. You know, you can get a bad ending to a book, or a sad ending to a book, or a book which makes you feel a bit sad in some ways, but the thing that makes a tragedy really tragic is that I can't pronounce the word tragedy. Is what makes it tragic. No, anyway, what really makes it tragic is that you know something bad is going to happen. You know, that's what you have in all these, you know, Greek tragedies. There's always something predicted at the beginning of the book. It's like, yes, this is going to happen. It's going to bring disaster on your country. And then, you know, Oedipus does it anyway or something. And that's what we get here as well. Charlie finds out quite quickly, and this is why it's not, like, it's a massive spoiler in some ways, but it's what we know is going to happen. Even at the beginning of the book, it's the foundation is set there, that Charlie knows he is going to become an idiot again. And the whole point of a tragic tale is that it doesn't matter what the main character, it doesn't matter what our protagonist is going to do, they're going to try hard to stop it, but then they're going to fail anyway. You know, I mean, this is really basic kind of, you know, literary criticism here. But what we have is that I realize here is that loss is far more devastating to me anyway than death. Because if something, you know, if someone ends in death or some, you know, that's sad. But loss is even worse. And that's why, you know, some great tragedies at the end of the book, someone doesn't die, you know, maybe they become blind. Because then they have to live with their loss, and that's something which really hits me. This book, I mean, it's completely different. I think I've actually talked about this film before, a film called The Mist, directed by Frank Darabont, and it's a short story by Stephen King, or a story by Stephen King. And that's a great pairing, because they, you know, that director and writer together did The Shawshank Redemption, so I thought, well, I'll watch this movie. And I heard it had a quite bleak ending, but it turned out to be the bleakest ending in the world ever I've ever seen of a movie. Like, everybody dying at the end of a movie? Yeah, it's to be expected and can be quite sad. You know, there's the film United 93, and I was just in tears at the end of that, mainly because it's sort of based on a true story, and it sort of tells the story of, you know, Flight 93 on September the 11th, 2001, and yeah, it's quite quite horrific in a way, that you know it's true and that everything that's going on there, and you know that everyone's going to die at the end. You know that's going to happen because that's what the story is. It's about the plane where everyone died on the end. Not even the terrorists managed to win. You know, they just crashed it into a field. So the whole Enterprise is, you know, you know what's going to happen, and you can see people reacting to it outside of it. But then by the end of the movie, everything just gets narrowed down into you only stay on the plane like the last 40 minutes of the film, or the last 20 minutes, like, I can't remember how much it is, but it's just on the plane, and that's all you get. You stay on the plane, and the last shot is the plane crashing into the ground. I'm not giving anything away here. That's what happens. You know it's going to happen. The ending isn't going to change that movie, but, you know, it killed me. You know, emotionally, I was a complete wreck. However, The Mist, this other film, everybody doesn't die at the end. Or let me put it this way. If everybody did die at the ending would have been happier. Because the ending is so full of despair that the movie studio actually said to Frank Darabont, look, make the ending a slightly happier ending or we can double you up. We'll give you twice as much money for you to make this film. And he says, no, I'm going to make the film. So he made it for like $20 million instead of $40 million or whatever. And so at the end, something happens, and I'm just like, fuck, that is like the worst, one of the worst endings of a film I've seen. And then the last 20 seconds of the movie, something else happened, and I'm just like, fuck! And it's, again, it's not about people dying, it's about loss, and it's about somebody knowing what they're doing and still losing it, and it's really bad. So anyway, at the end of this book, Charlie has gained so much throughout the book, and he's not just gained intelligence, he's gained understanding, and he's gained friendship, and he's gained relationships and stuff. And at the end, he knows he is losing everything. And I mentioned in the last podcast about me not crying at all during when I was reading or listening to the audiobook of Speed of Dark. And here, I had one of those visceral emotional experiences, like easily the most emotional experience I've had reading any book in the last 3 years of the Science Fiction Book Review podcast, by far as well, you know. And I said before, I don't mind crying, and it really was almost at the sort of same level of me just being in tears at the end of the book as I was at the end of the movie United 93. And the reason isn't, it's not purely down to me reading this book. Like I said, I knew what was going to happen at the end. You can see it coming a mile off. And, you know, Charlie's, you know, intellect sort of reduces down, and you can see it in the writing, which I'll get into more a bit later. Like I have this this iTunes playlist called Makes Luke Cry that I sometimes listen to on, and I include in there all of the music that I've ever listened to that has sort of affected me in an emotional time. Well, not the music itself, but when I've been in an emotional time in my life. I think it's quite healthy to sort of collect together those things that I can listen back to it and feel sad at some points, because I think I've mentioned this before on the podcast that sort of negative, otherwise negative emotions, like, as long as you're not experiencing them all the time, can actually, you know, be healthy. What's the point of going to heaven where everyone's happy all the time? You need that kind of you know, something to react against, to be happy all the time. You need the sadness to be there as well. So I think, you know, embracing sad emotions is good. And I was reading the last few pages of this, and I wasn't listening to that playlist, but I was just listening to my iTunes library on random. And this song started playing called Fix You by Coldplay. Now, this is a song which I already have an emotional connection, sort of a sad emotional connection to, because I once listened to a part of a soundtrack of a movie about a choir in America, which is all made up of old people who sing songs in a choir. It's like an old person's choir, and they sing "Fix You" by Coldplay, and it's an amazing rendition because it's a song about death. Or as far as I know, it's about a song about death. You know, the people about, you know, one of the lyrics is "Lights will guide you home and ignite your bones." You know, it's a song about, you know, sending someone off to be cremated and having old people singing in that. You know, sort of just, you know, if you don't have a tear in your eye listening to all of those, you know, old people singing that song, it's quite strange. So anyway, this song started playing when I was about 5 pages away from the end of this book. And, you know, I'm a pretty quick reader, so by the time it got to that sort of emotional part where it's literally the refrain is singing, "Tears roll down your face when you lose something you can't embrace," or something like that. And yeah, I was just a complete wreck, and I was listening to it, and I was thinking, this song is written about this book, although it isn't, because I know it's actually a song written about death rather than about flowers for Algernon. But I wrote down some of the lyrics here just in preparation for this review. It goes, when you try your best but you don't succeed, when you get what you want but not what you need, when you feel so tired that you can't sleep, stuck in reverse. And I'm like, holy shit, Chris Martin was reading Flowers for Algernon when he wrote this, but I knew he wasn't, but it was it touching me already. I was just crying my eyes out. And then it goes on, it goes, the next sort of verse bit, he goes, and tears come streaming down your face when you lose something you can't replace, when you love someone but it goes to waste, could it be worse? Lights will guide you home and ignite your bones, and I will try to fix you. And if you've ever read Flowers at Algernon, you know that all of these things are pretty much coming in the book. So I'm tearing up now as I talk about it. It's like, not just the tears that come streaming down your face, which is happening to me and happens to the characters in the book as well, but you lose something you can't replace, you love something but it goes to waste, you know, and someone trying to fix you and so. And I was just a wreck. And so, and then, the worst thing is, the next song comes, because I stopped, I took the... playlist off at random, and so I could just listen on to what's coming next and the album, just because I was curious. And also, I just, you know, was finishing up the book and wanting to sort of stay in that mood of me completely bawling my eyes out at this point. And, you know, oh yeah, and at the end, it's, could it be worse? And I'm thinking, yeah, loss is worse than death. This was a song written about death, and it was talking about, you know, but loss, I think, is worse than death, or can be. It hits me emotionally. So, the next song on the album is called Talk, and it goes, I'll just read some of these lyrics. Oh brother, I can't get through, I've been trying hard to reach you but I don't know what to do. Oh brother, I can't believe it's true, I'm scared about the future and I want to talk to you. Are you lost or incomplete? Do you feel like a puzzle, you can't find your missing piece? Tell me how you feel. Well, I feel like they're talking in a language I don't speak, and they're talking it to me. And again, I'm just like, this is a song about Flowers and Algernon. It's like, and then he goes, so you don't know where you're going, but you want to talk. You feel like you're going where you've been before. You tell anyone who listens that you feel ignored, but nothing's really making sense. No, nothing's really making any sense at all. And I'm like, just in tears at this point. And then the next song comes on and I'm like, Chris Martin, get out of my head at this moment in my life. The next song is called X and Y. It goes, trying hard to speak and fighting with my weak hands, driven to distraction, all part of the plan. When something is broken and you try to fix it, trying to repair it any way you can, and so on for the next two or three songs. And I don't want this review just to be me reciting Coldplay lyrics, but they hit really, really hard at a very specific point. Tears stream down your face, hell yeah. And again, this is an album that I bought because listening to one of the songs from this soundtrack made already hit me in an emotional way, and that it came on right at the end of a book called Flowers for Algernon, which I knew was probably going to affect me emotionally anyway at all. And yeah, just a complete wreck, just in tears for about 30 minutes there at all. And I've never had that kind of experience when reading a book before, or not that I can remember. Maybe close, like I said before, when I was listening to the audiobook of Slaughterhouse-Five, and then I listened to it at the last part again where they repeated something with musical accompaniment. And I think I need to do this more. I think people should actually say, hey, listen to this book and at this part play this song. We need some kind of soundtracks for books. It's like, at this chapter play this album, or at this section or at this part play this album. And of course, reading, you know, I was reading this not as an audiobook, I was actually just reading it you know, from the page, but as an ebook. Actually, I didn't have my iPhone is broken, so I had to actually read it on the screen, which is a bit annoying, but I guess at least I know I can read a whole novel if it's good on my laptop. So, yeah, you need, I think what we should do is have like a Kindle program, or that can go on an iPad or something like that, that when you get to a certain page in the book, it starts playing the correct music. You know, like you're having a computer game where you listen to, you know, you get to a certain point and it's sort of dynamically generated, soundtrack and stuff. I think we need that for books as well. Anyway. So, yeah, as you can tell, story very, very effective, and, let's say, very, very effectively written. So, the characters and stuff, first of all, the other characters in the book, I like how they sort of develop along with Charlie, and how he first looks at them, and then how he identifies with them, and then how he looks down at them. You know, he first looks up to them, and then looks down at them, and he sees them all from different angles. And I really like getting to know the other characters in the book from the different intellectual positions of Charlie, which I like that as well. And I liked his, you know, his love interests, and I liked his, you know, the scientist character, and also also I like the depth that he doesn't notice in people, and then as it develops on, like the depths of the people in the bakery and in his family, you know, all the dynamics there as well. One of the strangest things is how Charlie goes on a journey from being like this likable idiot who's always happy and smiling, to someone who is actually very unhappy and cynical. And then onwards through his sort of intellectual journey, his intellectual capacity is always running ahead of his emotional development on the way up and on the way down, which is really strange. So you can sort of like, in the middle of the book, I really couldn't identify with Charlie. Oh, I could in a way, but like, even though he was being a dick and like he's being really unpleasant to these people because, you know, he's intellectually their superior, and then he feels really sorry for himself. But you think, well, yeah, of course he's going to feel sorry for himself. He had an IQ of 180 something, and now he knows he's going to lose it all. Of course he's going to feel sorry for himself. But because you know what he was like at the beginning of the book, you can, yeah, it's a bit strange, but like you can identify with him and feel sorry for him even when he's being a complete dick, which is quite an achievement, I think, for a writer to do that. So yeah, character development, which is what the book is about, character development. So I'll get a bit more into that later as well. So science and technology, not much. I like science fiction where there's like only one change from reality, like one new technology or one invention or one alien invasion or something like that. And then we see how things play out in the world. But like I say, the vista of this book is not the world. It's sort of on a much smaller scale of one person's life, one man's life, and what changes about it, you know, and how it plays out with him and his relationships. So yeah, I really enjoy that, actually. I think even though, like I say, the science fiction invention itself is sort of explained away by, you know, mildly convincing technobabble, and also it's explained away by saying, like, you know, first of all, you know, Charlie not being able to understand the operation, and then when he does understand it, he understands it on such a high level that he can't explain it to even to the other scientists, let alone us who is a reader. So I quite like that kind of take on it, that he doesn't actually have to talk about or make the operation convincing. It's just sort of like a placeholder in a way. I can remember doing this or listening to a podcast. Did I take part in a podcast? I can't remember. With Eric Rabkin, who's this literature professor who talks quite a lot about fantasy and science fiction. And he did one of the teaching company series of lectures. Anyway, so on one of the podcasts that he did with the SFF Audio, he was talking about how the rules of Isaac Asimov's robot series they're not a science fiction invention. They're more of like a fantasy fairy tale. It's like saying, you know, a long time ago in a land far, far away, that kind of thing. Or once upon a time. As soon as you say the words once upon a time, you know that you're in a world where the rules are different and there's magic and things like that, and you go with it. And it's in the same way that the robot stories, all you need to go is like set out a book saying, these are the three laws of robotics. And you don't need to know how they work, you know, positronic brain, blah, blah, blah. It doesn't really matter. And you don't even need to know how it would ever be possible to talk about, you know, robots not harming other people or how that could even be programmed. You just bypass all of that just by a set of rules, in the same way that you say, once upon a time, you say the three rules of robotics. And then what happens then doesn't actually have to compare with reality. It just has to, you know, follow through the expectations of what you have. You know, it's a strange thing to say, but it was only when he actually said that I realized, yeah, a lot of these different devices in science fiction aren't, it doesn't mean that it's not science fiction, but it means that they're not wanting to explore the science and the technology part of it. What they're really wanting to do is tell a fairy tale, but using a device of science fiction to introduce the rules of the world. And I think that's what we do have here as well. We're going, right, we're in America, once upon a time in America, the scientists came up with a cool procedure. And it doesn't really matter what it is, but it sets us off on this sort of like almost mythic level, fairy tale level journey of, you know, personal growth throughout the book. Moving on to writing. The Ritter is written as a series of progress reports, like a journal, like a diary, and the scientists want to learn all they can from Charlie, so they say, hey, what we want you to do is keep a journal, and then, you know, we'll do this operation on you, and you can sort of, you know, keep track of what you're thinking. So at one point, it actually gets a bit too personal, so instead of this being a journal that Charlie delivers to the scientist, he says, well, I'm going to keep this journal a secret, and only when the experiment is over, and they really want to find out every single bit about it, and I'm fine with it, and, you know, I'll give them my permission to have a look through all of these journal entries and publish what they want, or keep what they want, and things like that. So journal entries written, of course, first person, not so much in present tense, but you know, that sort of continuous past tense kind of thing, diary entries in that way. So we get the development of the intelligence portrayed by the English writing capabilities. So that first of all, it starts out, the spelling is all over the place, the words are all over the place, there's no punctuation, only some full stops, doesn't really understand what's going on at all. And then as we go through the book and Charlie's intellect grows, he gets better spelling and more punctuation, he uses longer words and stuff. But it's more than just the words and the bits around the words and the choice of words, it's also the poetry of the words, and the literary style changes throughout the book. The descriptions have more life to them as he goes through. And, you know, when he recounts his trip to Chicago and he's talking about the science conference, it's real joy. You know, he, like, Charlie becomes a master storyteller halfway through the book. And, you know, he portrays his life and he portrays his experiences in such a way where it's actually a delight to read. And then, of course, when he loses his mental capacity, it sort of mirrors the first half in reverse as well. But it's more subtle. You know, he still remembers what it's like to be able to write, and he goes through this kind of stuff. And the whole recounting of experiences and how he loses his mental and writing capacities as well. His writing capacities along with his, his intellectual capacities is very, very well portrayed here. And, you know, the imagery as well changes throughout the book. Charlie doesn't know what a metaphor is. You know, very clearly they say, hey, let's do these Rorschach tests. So he looks at this ink and he's going, he said, what do you see? He's like, I see someone spilt some ink. It's like, no, but what do you see in the ink? He's like, well, the ink is black. And they're like, no, what do you see? And it's like that kind of stuff. So he doesn't even understand what a metaphor is. And then it goes through, he can't remember. And then by the end of the book, he can't remember how to apply a metaphor. And then he's trying to, you know, the metaphor sort of bleeds over into his life. He's trying to retain, he knows that he's going to lose what a metaphor is, so he's trying to keep his life as a metaphor, so he's living in a metaphor of his own life. At the end, he lives in this mess. He, you know, he rips up books and he smashes up records and he just leaves them around his apartment, and someone tries clearing up the apartment. He's like, no, I want you to leave the mess. I want to live in mess. Even though, you know, at the height of his abilities, he lived in somewhere, you know, in his apartment was kept exactly clean and perfect and everything was tidy. And he says, no, I want to live in a mess because that's the only way I can remember what it was like, these damaged books around me. I can't read them anymore because I don't understand the language in the books. They were in German. I can't remember how to speak German anymore. And my piano here as well. I used to play my piano, but now I'm going to smash my piano up. But I want to see the smashed piano to it's like a visual metaphor of what my life used to be. And again, in some ways he says it explicitly, but in other ways it's part of the writing style that we're actually exploring metaphor, real life metaphor, from someone who doesn't understand metaphor anymore and can't even grasp what metaphor is, and yet he's writing about it, not being able to explain how he's feeling metaphorically, only literally, but still sort of trying to live the metaphorical life. Well, it's strange. Anyway, let me put it this way. The writing of this book is a work of genius. The whole book is a work of genius, which actually is good because the book is also about genius. It's a work of genius by a genius, about genius for geniuses like me. No, I can't say that. But like I say, I think you do have to have a certain level of education and intellect to be able to understand this book, which brings me to talk about my themes. Now, like I said before, wasn't quite sure how to approach this. So like I did with... Slaughterhouse-5, I thought, well, let me check out some one-star reviews on Amazon. And it turns out all of the one-star reviews on Amazon are from kids who have been told to read this by their teacher and said, hey, read this book. It's you know, called Flowers for Algernon, and you'll really like it. So it's actually very funny and very ironic to read the one-star reviews on Amazon's about this. So let me just try some of these. Here it goes. I picked up this book because my friend said it was her favorite and her teacher agreed with her. I kept reading, waiting for the book to come interesting. It never did. It wasn't, no apostrophe, just that I was expecting fabulous book, and it didn't come up to what I thought it was going to be. It was just plain bad. Not everyone agrees with me, and I don't expect them to, but check out the book for yourself and see what you think. And I was reading that going, this is really hilarious. And then another one. When I first heard on Flowers for Algernon, I thought it would be a great book that would make me cry. I was wrong. The book was good at the begging. It made me feel sorry for the young Charlie. And that's not the only review which misspelt the name Beginning in this as well. Here's another book. I don't think this was a one-star book, but I quite liked reading through these ones. Flowers for Algernon, a book written by Daniel Keyes. The novel is about a retarded adult called Charlie Gordon. He is 33 years old. No commas or anything here. He is a person that has been rejected by society by the reason he is mentally retarded. He takes tests at the medical facility of Beacombe College, where they test his ability on solving maze against Algernon, a mouse lab, which the persons responsible of the experiment perform brain surgery to increase his intelligence. So I had a good laugh reading. Now, it's bad because the whole point of this book is, or one of the points of this book is that we shouldn't, you know, laugh about, you know, laugh at mentally retarded people, or adult, you know, people who are learning difficulties as well. Now, I'm not laughing at mentally retarded people. I'm laughing at kids who have been set this book at such a young age that they haven't, you know, they're one-star review books by school kids. They're too much like Charlie at the start of the book. I'm not saying that they're retarded or anything, but their spelling and punctuation is at a low level. And that really is indicative of the level of thought in exactly the same way that Daniel Keyes is portraying in the book. I mean, I looked on goodreads.com and I've just flicked through some of the reviews there because I didn't want to, you know, repeat too much about it, which I'm going to repeat now. But here, check this out. None of my friends on Goodreads have actually written a review, but the, you know, it's sort of like, when I first started the novel, I thought the author was terrible. On almost every page, there were thousands of incorrect spelling and grammar mistakes. But as I read along, I found that the author, Daniel Keyes, did this on purpose to match the personalities of the main character. He misspells many words because of his low IQ. Now, I'm being a bit hypocritical here because I have just said the same thing in my review, but that's not the main part. I mean, it was just because I always talk about writing style. That's what I'm going to talk about when I talk about writing style, and it is genius and stuff like that. But it's really funny that people, I know it's a bad decision, but people who are of the level of Charlie nearer the beginning of the book, on like the upward sweep of the book, that's what they appreciate about the book, or they don't appreciate about the book. Like I say, the people who give it one stars, they just think it's boring and stuff like that. And they're at this level, it's like, oh, isn't it clever that the level of the spelling is, you know, it is indicative of the thing. Whereas for me, that's almost a minor part of the book. It's a very clever part of the book. It's a genius part. No, it's not a minor part. It's a big part of the book, but there's so much other stuff going on in the book, a lot of which I don't want to talk about because I don't want to spoil. But just the idea of somebody living a metaphor is obviously a lot more than someone who has been giving this book when they're like 12 and just don't understand it going on about it. It's just like, it was just plain bad. Kind of level. And I really like what Daniel Keyes has done here, because he's almost commenting about like the way that people write now. It used to be that if you weren't very intelligent, you wouldn't write letters. I'm grossly overgeneralizing here, but what you do is that the letters that we have from the past are by people who would want to write a lot, and they would spend time writing, and of course they'd get good at writing. There's a reason why Anne Frank's diary is so read, because, you know, I'm just thinking of that because it's also a diary, but it's written by a young girl who's a really good writer and very intelligent and sees the world in such a way that of course it sticks with us, and that's the kind of stuff that we write. But now, in the age of the internet, we're exposed to writing from people. I'm not saying that they're not intelligent, but they just don't like writing. They obviously don't like writing because when they write, they just don't care about it. And that's why, generally, when anybody comments on one of my YouTube videos, and I get lots of comments on my YouTube videos, I can just disregard anybody's opinion about what they say to me or ask any questions or anything like that. If they don't use proper punctuation, if they don't use spelling, and if they don't form sentences in a correct structure, I just ignore them because, in my mind, I know it's bad, I know it's bigoted, but there's no reason for me to care about what they think because, you know, they're not expressing themselves properly. And, you know, it happens as well when you're chatting online. If someone sends me a message on Facebook, like, when, you know, it pops up at the bottom, and they don't, you know, and they don't use a full sentences, if they're just rambling and not using punctuation, I just ignore them. And, yeah, it's bad and stuff like that. But there's a good reason why there's I only actually chat on one forum on the internet, and that is the Geek Nights forum from the Front Row Crew forum from the Geek Nights podcast that I listen to, and that's because they enforce spelling and grammar, and they have a moderator. So if you go on there and you start, you know, discussing anything and you're not using proper English, they'll do inline edits in red type to edit your posts and to make them good English, and then you only have to do that about twice, and then either people leave the forum or they start using proper English. And it's great because I can just have discussions there. And I'm not saying the people who discuss there are any more or less intelligent than the people that chat elsewhere. It's just that they care about spelling enough to be able to write full sentences and long posts and stuff. And there's no avatars and there's no signature files and there's all the other crap which goes along with discussing stuff on the internet and forums and shit like that. It's just, it's all absent. And it's purely about the discussion. It's purely about the minds meeting rather than wading through bad English. And I know it's the case because there's other people I chat to online who I made friends with, you know, offline, who I chat to, and I'm just going to call out Rob Stone here as well. There's even, among his friends, we call it Stoneisms because his typing is just so bad. It's like he's typing with gloves on, or boxing gloves on in some cases. And sometimes you're looking and you go, I have no idea what he's saying. And you're like, what this? You know, it's when you're chatting online and stuff. So, yeah, that's an interesting thing. And I know he's no less intelligent than me or no more intelligent. Well, maybe he is more intelligent than me. You know, he works at a university. He's probably more intelligent than me. So it's one of those weird prejudices. I can't even say the word. Fuck, I'm talking all over the place today. So, yeah, it's one of those weird things that you just go with it. And that's what I really like about this book. So, yeah, maybe I'm being a bit... let me put it this way. I always want to present myself to other people, even though, like, today I can't even say the word tragedy and prejudiced. Maybe I should and R a lot less. But I think also talking quickly is a sign of intelligence. Maybe. I don't know. At least I've got a lot to say. So, I said before, this book is for geniuses, because I do think I'm a genius. But let me expound on this point a bit more. So, the development of the intelligence in this book, you can sort of pick out on the ladder where these other people stand, you know, these school kids who are writing one-stars reviews of this book and then thought, oh, I've written a review of a book, let me put it up on Amazon.com. And that's what, like, all of the 10 reviews that come up on Amazon.com, or the 10 one-star reviews that come up on Amazon.com about this book say. And so you can sort of pick out where they are on, like, the intelligence chart of Charlie Gordon. But then there's more than just the intelligence, there's also the emotional intelligence or the emotional capacity or the emotional understanding. So, like I said, here's just what I want to talk about here, is that I think I'm a genius. Most people would disagree, or many people might disagree. I'm not a genius in every area like Charlie Gordon becomes, but, you know, in some areas I think I'm a genius. One area is juggling, not maths, but juggling notation and things like that, because I developed a notation system for juggling called Beatmap, and as far as I can tell, and as far as anyone else has been able to tell, it's complete in that it, you know, by setting up four rules or axioms, I can encompass every single possible juggling pattern, as well as every pattern that has ever been notated in any other juggling notation. So it's like a Turing complete language of juggling. But, you know, like computer languages, some are great for one thing, and then, you know, even if they're all Turing complete, some are really well suited for doing this kind of stuff, and other things are really well suited for doing this kind of programming. And Beatmap is the same in that even though it's complete and that it can encompass every other juggling notation that's been developed or devised, it hasn't caught on, mainly because in some ways, well, let me put it this way. If there's a complicated pattern, it will turn out to be a complicated notation, and often it's easier just to say, oh, I do this, 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 and this, and this, and actually in person just explain it or demonstrate it with a video or something like that. And if it's a simple enough pattern to be expressed with just numbers and letters, there's other simpler notation systems which are a lot more restricted. They're not complete in any way. However, it's a lot easier to say, you know, 3, which is the siteswap notation of a 3-ball cascade, then is to say in Beatmap, which you would say 2x, 1 star, which, you know, it's more tricky to say it there. But then if you said, oh, I want to give a 3-ball pattern, describe a 3-ball pattern in siteswap, which is the same height of a 3-ball pattern in siteswap, but with it, it's got a higher level of energy, which is another nerdy juggling term as well, like that. Again, siteswap, you say 3, whereas in Beatmap, you could say 3x, 1, full stop, 1, 1, full stop, start. You know, and that you can go deep into the language, even though it's a little bit more complex to say, you can actually express a wider... Anyway, I don't need to do this kind of stuff. The point is that I'm a genius for thinking of this. And you may think, what's that? But, you know, it comes to the point where every time I talk to other jugglers about juggling patterns and notation or anything geeky like that, I think in beatmap notation rather than siteswap or any other notation that they do. And because the way that I think about juggling patterns actually encompasses everything else that anybody can think about juggling patterns, I can express what they're thinking in beatmap and understand what they're expressing in other notations instantly. Because, like I say, it's that's the kind of level that I think about juggling patterns. And again, what I'm talking about now is only like interesting to maybe like 5 or 10 other people in the entire world who also think about juggling patterns in the same level as I do and things like that. For example, like I've worked out how to express juggling patterns like a 3-ball cascade or the siteswap 441 on a transparent Mobius strip, like a Mobius loop. So at first glance, at any one point on the loop, it looks just like a, you know, the normal juggling pattern, but it turns out to be a 1-ball, one-handed pattern which interacts with its mirrored, staggered self through time. And again, that kind of stuff is fascinating to me, and I can understand it and even picture it and even understand it how that would look in the real world, which is really fucked up if you understand sort of like what a Mobius strip would mean if that timeline was expressed in 3 dimensions in a juggling pattern in real time. It's fucked up. But the point is that, the way that I think about juggling can do that. So the way that Charlie feels like in the middle of this book, where he is at this level to everybody else's, you know, areas of endeavor, he talks to this linguist and he's like, whoa, I'm way ahead of you, linguist. And he talks to, you know, he talks to these other people about brain development and psychology and economy and ecology and all these different areas. And he's way ahead of everyone in every single area. I know that in some very, very minute and very, very nerdy subject, I am actually at a higher level than other people. And however, unlike, and this is the key point here that I'm getting to now, unlike Charlie at his peak, I'm more like Charlie after his peak, sort of at the peak, on his way to be the peak of his emotional development, where he realizes that relationships with other people are important. Maybe not more important than being right or more important than pure intellectualism, but by, you know, having the emotional awareness to go with your intellectualism, it actually, you know, makes you a better human. And, you know, having an intrinsic understanding of juggling patterns at a level that I have is pretty cool. You know what's cooler? For me, it's cooler. It's like I started the British Young Juggler of the Year stage, like it's a show and a competition, and ran it for 5 years. And now loads of young jugglers have got into performing by that. They would have never started performing otherwise, but then they got more and more into juggling and started performing on stage. And then everywhere else in the UK, any other juggling convention in the UK, if they're looking for performers for their show, they can say, well, who has been performing in the British Young Juggler of the Year show, or who did we like in that show? And they get young performers in to perform and encourage them to do better as well. And some performers who, you know, some jugglers who would never perform before until they took part in the British Young Juggler of the Year show are now professional jugglers and are going on to circus school and they're doing other things like that. And also I help run juggling conventions and I organize events and I take photos of other jugglers and people, you know, like that. And I run workshops and teach other people and, you know, I share different things online, you know, videos and workshops and all these other things. Now, for me, the nerdy being like a cleverer juggler is way, way, way less important to me than being a sociable juggler and actually helping people out and, you know, not just helping people out, but actually connecting with people on a sort of a more social and emotional level. You know, when I'm on stage, I want to, you know, I never want people to think I'm a good juggler or anything like that. I always want them to think that I'm a funny guy or that I'm a nice guy and I'm an approachable guy. And actually, I am, you know, I am a pretty nice guy. I see other people at Charlie's peak that, despite their actual intelligence, they hold up intellectualism at the highest level and forget about what actually matters to people is lives, or what actually matters to people is emotional connections and social connections. And I know I've been there in the past as well, and I sometimes do hit that point as well. But I think this is very, this is one of the main themes of this book, is that despite intelligence, there is more to life. I know it sounds really simplistic when I say it like that, but this book, it's one of the standout themes of this book, and it is one that hits me most. And again, I'm coming back to it. Like I say, I can have good relationships with people who have bad spelling, but not if that's the basis of the relationship at the beginning. And again, that is me being an intellectual snob. So even while I'm saying I'm a genius with social skills, I'm a nerd that's self-aware. I also am self-aware of my bigoted nature when it comes to looking down on people with, you know, bad spelling skills or, you know, common accents and things like that. So anyway, there's a little bit more of my life philosophy coming out here. So I'm going to leave it there. There's loads more I could say about this, but I want to finish up before the hour is out of what I've gone now of almost 50 minutes here. So yeah, I'm going to give this book 5 stars because, it is a work of genius and it did affect me emotionally in some ways, which, again, that's what it comes down to. Intellectual genius is okay. I could demonstrate, other books which have been written or, you know, let me put it this way. Reading Neal Stephenson's Anathem, I had, I was just going, wow, this guy is amazing. Like I say, he restructured the entire universe from the Planck length up and, you know, and rewrote the entire history of the universe as if Platonism was the basis, you know, actually was true, you know, and all that kind of stuff. It's an amazing scientific, you know, and science fictional endeavor. And the book itself is, you know, way, way ambitious, but it didn't make me cry, you know, and I really liked Hyperion as well. The story and the writing in that was, well, not so much the story, but the individual stories and the writing styles and all the references it made and everything like that, I thought was just amazing. And there's other books as well, but I think the books which really get to me are the ones that hit me on an emotional level. And again, that's what the message of this book is. And again, a book like Earth Abides has the similar kind of thing. It's like, yeah, sure, being intellectual and doing all this other stuff, but there's more to life. And I think Jesse from the SFF Audio podcast, when we were talking about Earth Abides there as well, he said that he got that as well. It actually changed his outlook on life when he was reading a book like that. And I think this book should do it. So I think it is a book that everyone should read at least once. Actually, coming back here to the goodreads.com page, I think it's on the, I looked here, it says, this is in some lists. Oh, I can't see it now. It's in the best books ever, 137th out of, you know, the best books ever. And also it's 48th out of 2003 books in the list, books that everyone should read at least once. And I think it is one of those books. So that's it. 5 stars. No problem at all. And if you think it's boring, like the people who give it 1-star and 2-star reviews, or if you think it's predictable or not enough happens, you need more intelligence. And if you think the book is too much about sex, or that the sex in the book is just sex, you need sort of more emotional intelligence as well. Because sex can be many things, you know. Don't want to give away too much about the love triangle in this book, but the way, the resolution of the love triangle, I thought was stunning and just amazing. And surely, I'm quite sure that wasn't in the short story version as well, because I just didn't see it coming at all. But, amazing. So, thanks a lot for listening to this review. Next book that I'm reading is maybe Starship Troopers by Robert A. Heinlein. Maybe I'll do an end-of-year show as well. Maybe not, actually. I said in the last time, maybe I'll talk a bit about what I've learnt this year and stuff. But, fuck it. I think the best thing to do is actually talk about my life if people are interested in that, tied into the reviews that I'm doing. I think that's the best way. Anyway, go over to goodreads.com and become my friends. And also, if you go to sfbrp.com, you can just, there's links there. There's lists of all the books that are there, and you can click through and comment on my review on goodreads.com, or download it, or look through it by star rating and everything like that. So go to sfbrp.com and click on episode lists there. It's really easy. Or just become my friend on goodreads.com, and I can see, like everyone here, I can see what you think of books. Nobody's actually given it a full review here, but James, 4 stars, Dries, maybe that's how you pronounce the name, 4 stars, let me see, Niels, 4 stars, wow, nobody's giving it 5 stars, Jörg, 5 stars, Ryan, 3 stars, God, Ryan is better than that, Scott, 5 stars, Mindy, 5 stars. You know, that's a good thing. So I really enjoy actually seeing what people think about the books that I'm reading as well. And, you know, listeners to the SFBRP. So go on there, become my friends there. And other thing you can do is follow me on Twitter. I'm at Luke Burge on Twitter. You can see all the stuff that I'm posting on my blog. I'm doing lots of end of year, beginning of year blogging on lukeburge.com/blog. Or else, yeah, check out sfbrp.com and check out the new episode list there as well. I'm doing that because we're past 100 episodes, and iTunes only ever lists 100 episodes in the RSS feed that it does there. So if you want to find the earlier episodes, you can find them there on sfbrb.com. So, yes, that's it. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time. Oh no, wait a second. I normally give out an email address. You can email me, luke@juggler.net, if you've got any comments or any, you know, book suggestions or anything like that. That's the best way to get in hold of me. So there you go. I'm a genius.